But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot, and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, that they want to be a part of this conversation. And I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonia Kennebec here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and the moral obstacles around it. And we've had, this documentary had Wynne Wenders as the executive producer, of course, is a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, Wynne Wenders in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then, and obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian, and has made things like The Fog of War in the past. So he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers with the industry, to put their names on the credit of the film. And, you know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators, I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown off and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're really there just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like. So I find it difficult.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasises this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know, that what they've done to come out against the programme is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicted in the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realisation, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbour. And I don't think that realisation that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. Mm-hmm. And I think that's problematic.
Well, that's a really interesting point. We'll have to pause there just for now.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually pushed the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. We can't just bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body, and that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or like pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket, and a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry them back to their compound.
So it's Heather Leinberg. So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you've killed someone if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her. And you get the sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head. And that is a very powerful thing.
Mm. And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes. But in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Oh, certainly. They are victims as well. They're, I mean, secondary victims, I would say, but certainly. I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children. And to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24, so they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed effectively from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this, into this role. So it's really, it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America is doing to its own children, and here in this country in Britain as well, same thing. Certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history. One of the people involved in the program said,
"I have this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing. Yeah. They had good intentions at heart."
Exactly, but it's it is child abuse, and you see the impact, and the fact that they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because the therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified, and so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking. And you hear testimony from Heather in the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, "I think there's women and children here," and so on. And they're saying, "Are you sure? I don't think so. Let's fire anyway." And being overruled and so on. Absolutely. They are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
That's a good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. We see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US sort of suburban areas.
Yeah, I mean, the film sort of flips on its head halfway through, and we get a sense that the people who've been employed as watchers are now the watched. And you know, that is very much there in all those drone shots over American cities, American towns. Drones have revolutionized the way movies in general have been made, because now it's much cheaper to do aerial shots rather than hiring big bulky crane equipment. You can just fly a plane or fly a drone above people's heads. So that has changed as well, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many films on this subject. The technology, the form and the content are married in this respect.
I think one of the strengths of the documentary is it shows how barbaric and brutal drone strikes are. And Mike, if I could ask you, what did you make of this journey to Afghanistan and this story?
I liked it very much. I mean, we see so many documentaries that set out their case in the first hour and then spend the second hour driving home the same points over and over again. Here, I think you get a sense of a story developing in real time. There was a sense that this technology has been thrust upon us, and like I say, we're all negotiating our way through this moral maze. And when it does finally get to Afghanistan, you get a sense there from that clip, you know, the plane comes over, of just how normalized this kind of life has been. I mean, the fact it's called National Bird, would suggest that the drone has now become part of the natural order of things, part of the landscape for so many people, in ways both good and terrifying.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting point. And Dan, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Mike just said? What did you make of the journey to Afghanistan in this documentary?
Well, I was glad they included it, because about 40 minutes into the film, I thought, are we going to hear anything from any Afghans whatsoever? And they did spend an extended period of time in Afghanistan. But as I said, I still didn't feel really they came across fully as agents. They were still depicted as, okay, they were shown as suffering and as victims, but there's portrayed as only victims, just kind of passive recipients, really, of U.S. air power. There was no agency there, no narrative, no Afghan narrative was present, and there was no politics whatsoever in the film. And I think there's a real danger. The Glasgow Media Group carried a really interesting study out a few years ago on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and they found that a lot of journalists were quite sympathetic to the Palestinians, but they knew that they weren't really allowed in Western media to actually put forward a Palestinian narrative about resistance to occupation and so on. So instead of that, in place of that, they just paraded this endless parade of Palestinian suffering, but overlain with an Israeli narrative to justify it. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger by not giving any kind of Afghan narrative, we just see, okay, we see the Afghan suffering, but there's no narrative, there's no other side of the story. The danger is that you have the same thing with the Palestine-Israel conflict, which people have pity for the Palestinians, but the overall view in the West, whenever Israel attacks, is, well, it's a sort of necessary evil in the war against terrorism. It's terribly sad, and we pity them, but it kind of has to be done. And I think there's a danger this film will have the same effect. People feel sorry for the Afghans, they'll pity them, but won't necessarily just see, oh, it's a shame these innocent bystanders die and so on, but that's kind of necessary.
Mike, so would you have liked to see more political context to this documentary?
There's certainly scope for a more comprehensive and possibly slightly drier documentary about drone technology and the politics of deployment. I mean, this is not a film about the systemic application of drone technology. It's not about the technological specifics of it. It is a human story, and those are the documentaries that tend to get sold at international marketplaces, play at festivals these days, because they're very easy to relate to. Mm-hmm. I still think we're in the early days of the early days of this technology, and there will be a more comprehensive documentary than the ones that we've seen so far. But in terms of a primer of how this affects both the watched and the watchers, I thought it was pretty solid.
Mm. Well, thank you for that point.
This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening.
So Mike, in the documentary we hear from President Obama give a televised speech talking about the drone warfare operation. And he says how it operates in such a way to ensure minimal loss of life and that they're precise and surgical strikes. Of course, in the documentary, we learn that it isn't really that precise. And Daniel even says, one of the characters, that an element of guesswork is involved. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I mean, everyone does seem to be operating in some kind of grey area. I mean, we've seen from the clips that actually the images that the drones beam back to the operators in America are very fuzzy. I mean, there's a degree of ambiguity in those very images, never mind in the ethics of using this technology. And so what's interesting is what the film says about the way this technology has been sold to us. So it's clearly been sold to young army recruits as an exciting new development in the war on terror, and we see the adverts in the films that are all, they are like an advert for a computer game, as you say. But there's also a degree to which you think someone must have sold President Obama on this, that this is a new, clean way of killing, that you're killing, you're somehow keeping killing at arm's length, but you're still getting dirty hands. And I think this is something that all the people in the film are wrestling with.
Mm. Now, Dan, I think many people would be surprised to find that actually there were 10 times more strikes during President Obama's presidency than under George W. Bush's predecessor. What do you make of Obama's role in the drone warfare?
Well, on the one hand, drone warfare is a kind of terrifying, dystopian kind of future brought into the present. But at the same time, that shouldn't blind us to the fact that it is driven by desperation on the part of the Western powers. They tried big ground operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fallout in terms of blood and treasure was so great that they just are not in a position to do that again. Mm-hmm. The Colin Powell said the U.S. Army is just about broken by Iraq. So they don't have that option. So when you say, it was Obama who sold Obama on this idea, well, the reality was he didn't, if he wanted to continue making war, and there's a whole systemic pressure to do so within the U.S. government apparatus, mm-hmm. then, the former options have been ruled out. Mm-hmm. It's no longer feasible to have these mass ground scale
Like in the Vietnam War, over 50,000 U.S. personnel died.
Right.
And this was one of the factors that led to the pressure of the government to pull out.
Yeah.
But do you think if they had drones at the time that they would just have an endless war?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? And quite feasibly, yeah, because it was the body bag coming home from Vietnam that drove the pressure to end the war. You're right. With mm-hmm. drones, there's no U.S. body bags. There's only Afghan body bags. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously mental health fallout. Well, it's interesting that U.S. casualties do exist. Heather talked about three of her friends on the drone program committing suicide. Mm-hmm. But of course, that doesn't have this generate the same headlines as a coffin coming home draped in a flag. Mm.
And a final say to you, Mike, would you recommend this documentary?
I think it's certainly worth watching. I think, this is one of those technologies that is that has proliferated very quickly. And like I say, we're all still wrestling with the ramifications of it, the consequences of it. It's not a bad place to start. I still think there'll be a more comprehensive documentary some years down the line.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your insights. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Duck Review. And thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Duck Review.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
We thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala again for the opportunity of going through the month of Ramadan and the opportunity of Eid. This great Eid that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt and their followers, the Muslim Ummah, and anyone who would want to join their path. This great blessing and gift has been bestowed upon us all, inshallah. He showers us with His mercy. One of the lines that we have in the dua of the Qunut that we are to be reciting in the Eid prayer for 9 times, which tells us that this request, this want, is one which on this day we should expect, we should ask and want and hope that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to grant us. Allahumma inni as'aluka خير ما سألك منه عبادك الصالحون. I ask you, the best of what the righteous servants of yours have asked for. وأعوذ بك مما استعاذ منه عبادك الصالحون. And I seek refuge in you from what the best and the most righteous of your servants have sought refuge in. A quick reminder regarding that, we ask this, the meanings of the words are pretty clear. Let's leave our thoughts and our minds regarding this dua. Allahumma inni as'aluka khayra ma sa'alak, the best of which the righteous servants of yours asked you. What that is has not been mentioned. And while we can have our minds think about that, and I'll say a few words regarding that, based on what the Quran says the righteous people want, and what they should want, and the direction that we should have, not based on what just comes to mind or what I wish or desire. The Quran tells us what the believers and the salihun want. Ibrahim is one who asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ, make me join the salihin in the hereafter. While he was in the dunya, he made that request to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So these are the people. But before getting into that little explanation that we can derive from the Quran, I want to make sure that we understand that there's a reason why in the prayer and in the dua of the prayer, it's been left as such. It doesn't mention inni as'aluka al-jannah or as'aluka whatever it is. Nothing particular has been mentioned. Rather, it says khayra ma sa'alak. One of the reasons perhaps that we have been told to ask in this language with this wording is to remove the limits of our imagination when we're asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for a great gift on the day of Eid, which, as I said, is a day, according to this dua and according to other riwayat, is a great day and we should expect great gifts. Our imagination can be limiting because our comprehension of what we can get is limited. And when that's limited, what we ask for will be limited to what we currently understand and comprehend. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has taught us a wording through the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt that removes that limit. I think we had a discussion on one of the nights of the month of Ramadan explaining that the dua that Prophet Musa has after escaping Egypt from the Fir'aun and his troops that were looking for him after he accidentally took a life that he didn't plan on. He escaped and he ended up in the pond or the lake of Madian, and where he saw the daughters of Shu'aib, and he didn't know they are the daughters of Shu'aib, and he helped them out. After he helped them out, they left. He said, رَبِّ إِنِّي لِمَا أَنزَلْتَ إِلَيَّ مِنْ خَيْرٍ فَقِيرٍ. Removing any thoughts of what it is, just acknowledging, I need your khayr, whatever you think is khayr. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala granted him things that at that point he didn't even comprehend based on what we understand from the verse. He didn't expect for any of what happens afterwards to come his way. Just asked for khayr. It wasn't on his mind. He asked for khayr that God knows, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave him so much. Here, we're asking for the best thing that those people asked for. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala guides the righteous people to what they should accomplish, and they ask for it and they are granted that. Eventually, that's what it gets. Musa was later trained further and further, and he knew more and more which he should want, and he asked for, and he got. Prophet Ibrahim asks for things later in his life. For example, on the day where they finished and completed the reconstruction of the Kaaba, Ibrahim came to a point after all these years of seemingly submitting to Allah and His will and His command. From his younger days in Babylonia, in Bainun Nahrain, in current day Iraq, moving to the Holy Land in Palestine. From those days he submitted to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's will. However, after all these tests, all these years, taking Ismail and Hajar, leaving them in the desert without anything, because God said this is submission. Now after years coming, now seeing his son Ismail, after they complete the Kaaba, now he asks this, رَبَّنَا وَاجْعَلْنَا مُسْلِمَيْنِ لَكَ وَمِنْ ذُرِّيَّتِنَا. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala taught him that you need to ask that you become a Muslim. A Muslim, you have submitted, but you are not someone who is submitting. Someone who is a submitter, I want to use a noun for that. It means that they are constantly in the state of full submission to Allah. After all those years, Ibrahim is told that you're not there yet. You need to ask for that. If he would have been told to ask for it, what he would have been thinking of the idea of submission would have been limited. At this point, what he asks for is رَبَّنَا وَجْعَلْنَا مُسْلِمَيْنِ لَكْ وَمِنْ ذُرِّيَّتِنَا أُمَّةً مُسْلِمَةً. From myself, from my son, and for our progeny, an ummah that submits. We have trouble understanding, even at this point, what that Islam is. All of us have trouble understanding what that Islam is. We consider ourselves Muslim. We consider ourselves those who have submitted to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We are submitting to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, seemingly at a very, very basic, low level, below standard, I should say. But we understand that submitting to God's will has a certain definition. That definition that we understand of submission is deficient. If we were to ask that word and that submission, what we think of it is not exactly there. In the dua, if we think of the word khair in a limited form of it and ask, that's going to limit our dua. But if we realize that the word khair is limited only by something which is limitless, in other words, khair is whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings, and He is infinite, He is limitless, and what He can give is limitless. And so the khair that the righteous people asked for is limitless, whatever more specifically that is. If we keep our minds open like that, inshallah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will grant us.
Feeling so good, smiles and greetings everywhere. Eidun Mubarak to everyone out there. Whole families, they gather and celebrate. Today's the day, so come on, no time to waste. Sometimes the world takes us so far, though miles apart. Today you're in my heart, Eidun Sa'id, let's enjoy this happy day. Eidun Mubarak, come on, let's celebrate. Eidun Sa'id, let's enjoy this happy day. Eidun Mubarak, come on, let's celebrate, celebrate, let's celebrate. Allah, Allah, thank you for this day.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Muhammad Mahmoud Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبه نستعين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, welcome once again to yet another episode of The Bridge, a program in which we try to discuss the different supplications of Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam, supplications that have come in the form of a prayer manual known as As-Sahifatu As-Sajjadiyah. We have been discussing the seventh supplication, which is Imam Sajjad alayhi salam's supplication during incidents of sorrow, painful occasions, and intense grief. We just started discussing verse number 3, where Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam talks about two important things: that whatever happens is by His will. He doesn't need to express or command something to happen, and we explained what it means. فَهِيَ بِمَشِيَّتِكَ دُونَ قَوْلِكَ مُؤْتَمِرًا. Thus it is solely through your desire without expressing your command that they, the things, submit to your command. وَبِإِرَادَتِكَ دُونَ نَهْيِكَ مُنْزَجِرًا. And it is solely through your will without expressing your prohibition that they are prevented from your prohibitions. And therefore here actually it talks about the ontological command, not the legislative command, because in terms of legislation, you find that the human being has ikhtiyar and has a volition to do something or not to do something. Yes, ultimately, whatever he does also is by Allah's ontological permission, and therefore that is there. But he has been given to choose what he wants. But when it comes to this command that Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam is expressing, it is actually ontological command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that anything that Allah wants will happen. That thing comes into being submissively. There is no kind of irada in that being to say that I don't want to come into being. No, that cannot transpire. And if anything Allah doesn't want to happen, it will not happen. When He prohibits something to happen, He doesn't want something to happen, ontologically, it will not transpire, whatever a person does. Even if a person uses his willpower that Allah has given him, ultimately it is out of Allah's wisdom that he does whatever he does. And therefore he can even impede the person's way. Ultimately, anything that happens or anything that is impeded or prevented to happen is by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's irada and will. And we cannot say that, you know, we can do whatever we want. Even those people who are committing atrocities and crimes, they might think that, no, we are doing it independently. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would have blocked us. And this is how they try to argue. But they don't realize that everything that happens is out of Allah's wisdom, mercy, and love. That is something very, very important and deep that a person should realize. Apparently, it may be a very uncomfortable scenario, situation. But then if a person looks at it holistically, and he realizes afterwards, he comes to realize that, yes, this was Aynur Rahma.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana.
If you look at the whole Karbala event, you will find that subtle or that hidden dimension of Karbala was seen by the likes of Bibi Zainab alayhi salam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the Shuhada of Karbala, even the Urafa, one of the great Urafa of the 20th century, Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Tehrani, in his book, his memoirs about his Ustad, Ustad Haddad al-Musawi, who was a saint and who was a master in mysticism, and he was his master in taking him to the way towards mysticism. Ayatollah Muhammad Hussein Tehrani, in his book Ruha Mujarrad, Spirit Immaterial, or The Liberated Soul, this has been translated with a very good translation recently, known as Liberated Soul. In it, he mentions a very thought-provoking statement, apparently from his mentor. He says that if the mystics would have seen a fraction of what transpired in the plains of Karbala, they would have gone to prostration up to the day of judgment out of thankfulness of what transpired in the plains of Karbala. So a person looks at the outer events, the outer phenomenon, and there he thinks that, oh, there were so many problems that happened to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and he lost his dear ones. Yes, this happened. Obviously, a lay person looks at it that way. A person who has not yet gone through spiritual training and gone through the spiritual wayfaring, when he looks at the incidents, he looks at it from the apparent view and is very sad, and he always laments for it. But a person who comes to a higher level, he realizes that the Shuhada of Karbala were enjoying in the heights of their perfection with the beauties that we cannot even imagine. As one of the great scholars, the contemporary great scholar Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, in one of his statements says something very beautifully. He says, that shaheed, that person who is suffering, you think he is suffering as he is leaving this world and he is shaking. Do you realize that perhaps he is dancing out of the things that he sees and he is about to get, and he goes to the higher realms because he has sincerely sacrificed himself for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Why are you looking at the apparent things? Look at the inner and the subtle things, the kernel of what is transpiring. And therefore, when we express and say, فهي بمشيتك دون قولك مؤتمرة وبإرادتك دون نهيك منزجرة. It is as if we are expressing our approval that, oh Allah, what is happening, what you are making happen, because everything is in your hands, is good. Yes, apparently there are atrocities that are happening, and those people who do these atrocities will be punished, the kuffar will be punished because of their oppression. But then the people who are oppressed and they are innocent must realize that this itself has very beautiful effects for them, but they cannot see. They only look at the periphery. They have not seen the center. Inshallah, we'll continue with our discussion in our next session. We come to the end of the program. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين.
That was the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Khalfan, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهن عشق و تولای تو را
attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. On Monday, over 300 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops fired rubber bullets on them around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Scores were detained by Israeli forces. The protests erupted after Israeli troops stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in an effort to force out the Palestinians. The violence around the mosque and the Old City were the worst since 2017, fueled by a years-long bid by Israeli settlers to take over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Israeli regime is also celebrating its 1967 occupation of Jerusalem al-Quds.
There are several facts here. One is that this is a process of, once again, of ethnic cleansing in broad daylight. It is a provocation, obvious provocation against Islam, and has appropriately been denounced by most Arab countries, including a couple of them who are overly anxious to normalize relations with Israel and hopefully will now reconsider what they've done.
Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, the imam and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, has condemned the attack, calling the raid a heinous crime that cannot be tolerated. Leader of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, Mustafa Barghouti, called the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque compound a criminal act. Barghouti described the raid as a racist act by an apartheid regime.
Well, Israel is indisputably an apartheid state. It always has been from the outset, from 1948 on. It simply wasn't called that. The apartheid nature of Israel was confirmed in 1967 when it invaded the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Mustafa Barghouti is absolutely 100% right when he calls it a criminal act.
The military brigade of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, also warned against the presence of Israeli forces in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is so fluid, and resistance movements fired tens of rockets toward occupied Palestine Monday afternoon. The clashes in Al-Aqsa Mosque have drawn widespread condemnation from the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions, saying Israeli authorities must exercise maximum restraint. The U.S. government, however, stopped short of condemning the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan instead conveyed serious concern to his Israeli counterpart about violent confrontations in Jerusalem and Al-Quds. Arab nations, including Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, also hit out at Israel over the Jerusalem violence. Some Arab countries, including those that last year normalized relations with Israel, condemned the Israeli aggression. Iran, Pakistan, and many other nations also slammed the attack. In Britain, Germany, Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere, people took to the streets to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities and voice solidarity with the Palestinian people. In some countries like Oman, people gathered in front of the Israeli embassy to condemn the raids.
It's clear, I think, to the peoples of the world, even if it's not necessarily to political classes in the Occident, in the West, that the Israeli regime is a criminal entity, and what they're seeing practiced against the Palestinian people, Palestinian worshippers, which is really the reflection of a process that's gone on for far too long and backed by Western governments, specifically Washington and its allies. So there's no surprise in the fact that people everywhere in the world are outraged.
The Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is nothing new. Israel has done similar acts in the past many times. Tel Aviv has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since its installment in the region by its Western creators. The regime enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular.
The reason that Israel was created in the first place was that it was meant to be a foothold for British expansion into the region and to the control of oil and gas, natural gas resources in the region.
What is clear is the fact that the Israeli aggression against Palestinians cannot end through dialogue. Israel has defied calls to stop violating the rights of Palestinians for decades. Many factions in Palestine have also come to the conclusion that Israel can be pushed back only through resistance, and that any effort short of resistance will come to nothing given Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime at the UN Security Council, the only world body that can issue a binding resolution against the regime.
The people of Palestine have long suffered aggression at the hands of Israel, but that escalated to epic proportions in this Ramadan. The regime launched a crackdown on Palestinian worshippers and restricted their gatherings in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds during the Muslim holy month. Later in the month, an Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem al-Quds immediately, despite having lived there for generations. The eviction order sparked several protests in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The crackdown on ensued injured hundreds of Palestinians. It also drew condemnations from the international community against Israel, with even the Arab countries that have recently normalized ties with the regime, namely Sudan, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, denouncing the Israeli forces' storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
It's not only the general oppression of Israel, but Israel got very aggressive with the district of Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, where they want to get rid of all the remaining Palestinian families. The Israelis, I think, did not anticipate what they were stepping into when they chose to evict all of these families at the same time in the month of Ramadan.
The United Nations Human Rights Office urged Israel to cease the eviction order immediately. It said The transfer of parts of an occupying power's civilian population into the territory that it occupies is prohibited under international humanitarian law and may amount to a war crime. Israel has been trying to downplay the recent clashes, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu strongly rejecting international pressure not to build settlements in Jerusalem al-Quds.
We also firmly reject the pressures not to build in Jerusalem. To my regret, these pressures have been increasing of late. I say also to the best of our friends, Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and just as every nation builds in its capital and builds up its capital, we also have the right to build in Jerusalem and to build up Jerusalem. That is what we have done, and that is what we will continue to do.
But under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement-building activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Jerusalem al-Quds remains at heart of a decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers say the recent escalation of violence surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque could be a prelude to a third intifada.
As far as I'm concerned, an intifada is always possible in Palestine. The Israelis are putting more and more pressure. They're hoping to keep the pressure at just the right level to cause, to motivate the ethnic cleansing, the expulsion of the Palestinians, the marginalization of the Palestinians, without having it explode completely.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's all-out support, Israel has stepped up its aggression against the Palestinian people. But with Trump gone, for how long can it keep on committing its crimes?
The coronavirus pandemic has struck a heavy blow against major economies across the globe. Many people have lost their jobs or seen their income cut. However, development of vaccines was a breakthrough. Countries across the globe launched vaccination programs in order to reverse this negative trend and help their economies recover. Yet things have not worked out well for the world's largest economy, the U.S. According to the latest monthly employment report by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. economy gained only 266,000 jobs last month. That is while economists had expected the number to top 1 million. Also, the unemployment rate rose to 6.1% amid an increasing shortage of available workers. But there were more bad news, as March's originally estimated 916,000 job gains were revised down to 770,000. Vaccination efforts and the relaxing of lockdown measures across the U.S. were expected to result in steady job growth. Yet the disappointing report is a surprise setback for U.S. President Joe Biden's efforts to revive America's economy from the coronavirus pandemic conundrum.
We came to office, we knew we were facing a once-in-a-century pandemic and a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. And we knew this wouldn't be a sprint, it'd be a marathon.
The April data shows the U.S. economy still has 8.2 million fewer jobs than it had in February of 2020, before the pandemic hit.
We're still digging out of an economic collapse that cost us 22 million jobs. Let me say that again. It cost us 22 million jobs. When we came in, we inherited a year of profound economic crisis and mismanagement on the virus.
Biden claims his $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package is helping the U.S. economy to recover and is also pushing for another $4 trillion to be spent on infrastructure, education, and other priorities. However, his critics object to the high price tag and are warning that that could bring inflation. Moreover, Republicans and business groups have raised concerns about a disincentive for people to return to their jobs.
The reality was 75% less than what they had predicted. So it's a huge shortfall. I believe the economy is much weaker. I believe all the talk about a super powerful recovery was overdone. I think the economy is really struggling with the after effects of the pandemic. It's listless, it's weak, there are huge financial problems.
The U.S. Labor Department's monthly report fell significantly short of expectations. While economists predicted that the economy would add about 1 million jobs, the report was a huge disappointment. Economists attribute the disappointing results to a range of issues, including safety concerns, child care issues, as well as extended unemployment benefits. In addition, according to government surveys, the number of unemployed workers is way higher than job openings. Also, there have not been any meaningful wage increases either, which are a hallmark of labor shortage.
There's a lot of speculation as to why. The Republicans, the conservatives blame it on overgenerous unemployment benefits. I'm very skeptical. I think those jobs do not pay very well. I think if wages were higher, workers would be quicker to sign on. But as things stand now, the wages are so low that it may be more worth their while to stay at home and take care of the kids.
Unemployment rates for black and Latino women remained high. That is while women are being employed at lower rates in the U.S. Meanwhile, the hard-hit hospitality sector, which includes restaurants and hotels, and also manufacturing sectors, are unable to fill their job openings. That is while the unemployment rate is at high levels. Many unemployed Americans are reluctant to look for jobs because they fear catching the coronavirus. Others have entered new occupations and have left their old jobs. Moreover, many women, working mothers in particular, have left the workforce to care for children. Republicans and critics blame the Biden administration's policies for the slow economic recovery.
Well, that's what the Republicans complain. They want to see unemployment benefits cut because they want to force workers to go back to work. But it's very hard to tell. The wages have fallen very low, and workers have a lot of responsibilities at home.
The latest report reveals that the U.S. economy still has a long way to go to recover from the coronavirus pandemic.
The remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have been meeting in the Austrian capital, Vienna, in recent weeks to find a way to salvage the international accord. While few details about the talks have been revealed, Press TV has learned that the U.S. and the European signatories to the deal apparently want the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in return for a temporary suspension of some of the sanctions related to the nuclear deal, officially titled the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. This is while, under the JCPOA, Iran's advanced centrifuges, including IR-4, IR-6, and IR-9s, must be stored away under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency and not destroyed. Press TV obtained information that shows Iran won't give in to the excessive demands of the Westerners, and also in case of insistence on the part of the other side, the possibility of the JCPOA, and not just the negotiations in Vienna, unraveling altogether will be real.
The Iranians have seen what the Americans and the Europeans have done. They've talked and talked and talked a lot about how they want the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to succeed, and yet they've done everything in their power to ensure that it won't succeed. The Europeans refuse to permit to trade with Iran in any kind of barter arrangement, even with that INSTEX, that International Exchange Program. So they're simply kowtowing to the Americans, acting as their running dogs, and simply making a big production out of nothing. It's a simple matter to abolish the sanctions and rejoin the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But of course, they won't do that, and they want to blame the Iranians for their own failures.
The new demands, meant to impose new nuclear commitments on Iran, have been put forward while the U.S. has not even agreed to remove all the JCPOA-related sanctions, a condition set by Tehran for a possible U.S. return to the nuclear deal. U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed his willingness to reverse Trump's